My topic is observed properties of accreting white dwarfs, which is a pretty big topic. So I've tried to narrow it down to four different parts. I'll talk about the mass, the temperature, composition, and rotation. And both Boris and Tom have covered a little bit about the mass and composition. So that's helpful. I can move through some of that faster. So the basic problem when we're trying to look at the properties of the accreting white dwarf is to just see the white dwarf, because there's so much obscuration in the usual case with the material that is doing the accretion. So in a disk situation, we have to try to look for the systems where the disk is not going to be a major contributor to the light. And that's generally going to be in the very short period systems, or the special case where the mass transfer stops and basically the disk goes away for a while. That happens between periods of 3 and 4 hours. For the magnetic systems with a very magnetic white dwarf, here the light is dominated by the accretion column. And again, for unknown reasons, the mass transfer stops in these systems. And that accretion can basically go away, and we can actually see the bare white dwarf. For the intermediate cases where there's still some disk, but the inner part is funneled, we really have no, there's a couple cases where the accretion stops, but we don't have any good data during that time, so we really have no information about the underlying white dwarf. So here's the case for a disk situation. When the disk is in a normal high accretion state, we really, that disk light obscures the white dwarf totally. And so we have to wait for look for the cases where that disk is a low contributor or basically goes away. And in the case of a magnetic system, this column is the dominant contributor to the light. And we have to wait for the times when the system, the transfer stops for these unknown reasons, and we can actually see the underlying star. So this is the situation observationally when we look at a CV. You know, I dare you to try to find the white dwarf in here. And I've helped you a little bit by putting these little stars here. Because most of the time, you're just seeing the underlying continuum from the disk and these strong emission lines. But in the few cases where, so the scale on all of these is the same. It's 10 to the minus 17th. So if you look at the ones where the numbers are very low, like here and here, we're down near 2 and 4 times 10 to the minus 17th is a scaling factor. In all of these, you're down in the very low mass transfer cases. And in that situation, you can actually see this underlying absorption surrounding the emission lines. And in this particular case, that's a polar I'll be talking about. This is a very low accretion rate polar, or LARP. And that continuum in these little flat stretches here is what you're seeing is the white dwarf. So those are the ones we look for. Of the hundreds of CVs that have been found, we look for the ones that show those particular features. So for the cases where we can actually get some handle on the white dwarf, we can try to look for the mass. And as you all learned in your beginning astronomy course, the only way to really get a good mass determination is to use a double-lined eclipsing spectroscopic binary. And that's very, very difficult, because the double line means you must be seeing the lines from the white dwarf, the absorption lines, not the usual emission lines. So what people have done, and I think Al Shafter did his thesis on this, is try to find methods to actually use the emission lines from the disk that has the velocity wings, which are the inner part of the disk and close to the white dwarf, and assuming you're trying to get a velocity for the white dwarf. So if you really want to do this right, you have to be able to see the absorption lines from the white dwarf as well as the companion star. And there's just not very many of those. UGM is one good case. Where the UV, we have a good velocity curve for the white dwarf, and we can actually see the M5 companion. The other way, and that's where most of these numbers have come from, is to do a photometric solution like Tom talked about yesterday, where you can actually resolve the eclipse very well with very good signal to noise, and you can see the little edges where the white dwarf is eclipsed in the hot spot, and you can separate everything out in a good model. So that's where most of these numbers come from. So I went through the literature, and this is kind of my list. Everybody has a different list of the masses they trust. But the general result is, so I've divided these into the disk systems, the very magnetic systems, and these are in the low states where you're actually seeing the white dwarf and the secondary star. Novae, you just can't do it with novae, because novae have usually very high accretion rates, so that disk is very extensive after a nova outburst, and you can wait 100 years for things to go down far enough that you can actually see the underlying stars. So there's really only one good mass determination for a nova, and that's DQHER. And then only recently, this is the one Tom showed you yesterday, the eclipsing AMCVM that's been discovered from Sloan and has a mass. So what you can see from all of these is the mass is basically higher than for single white dwarfs. So we're talking about numbers like 0.8, 0.9 for most of these systems. There really isn't any difference. I think someone mentioned yesterday that polars maybe should have higher masses. It doesn't really, you know, nothing stands out other than that the masses are greater than 0.6. All right, temperatures. We can do a little bit better with temperatures than we can with masses. With temperatures, we can observe in the ultraviolet where the white dwarf light, if it's a hot white dwarf especially, will dominate over the light from the disk. And if we can get the situations where the disk or the accretion column goes away, then we get an absolute really good temperature for the white dwarf. So we can observe, try to catch them at quiescence for sure, low states when the transfer stops, and do the UV, then we're in the best situation. And basically the shortest orbital periods are the ones that have the lowest mass transfer, so those are the ones that you have the best chance of getting a temperature for. So there's a couple cases we can concentrate on. The situation of orbital periods between 3 and 4 hours, those are the systems where the mass transfer can turn off, and you can actually see the underlying stars. So for 4 or 5 systems, we've been able to catch those. This was one where we caught serendipitously. We were trying for a high state and the transfer turned off. But you can see what's happening here. It's opposite to what you'd think. The red line here is actually the low state, and the spectrum is totally different in the low state than in the high state, which is the blue. And what's happening here is in the high state, this is an edge-on system, the high state, the disk is puffed up, it blocks the white dwarf. So when the mass transfer stops, you can actually see the underlying star and get its temperature. And in these systems between 3 and 4 hours, the accretion rate is high, the white dwarfs are hot, and you get a very nice fit. This is a work with Christian Knigge on DW UMA, and you can see that the temperature is very well determined for this system. So the other case where we have a good chance at it, as Boris pointed out yesterday, are the ones that have very low mass transfer rates, and so you see this absorptions happening around the Balmer lines. And so we can target those with HST to try to get a good temperature for them. And this shows you the reason why we have to use the UV rather than the optical. In GW Libra, which is one orbital period near 80 minutes and very low mass transfer rate, so this is our optical spectrum from APO, and this is the H beta and H alpha. You can see it's really difficult to fit anything. So you're primarily using the higher order Balmer lines, and these are various white dwarf temperatures. And the best one was kind of the second one down here that we determined a temperature of about 11,000 plus or minus 1,000. But then when we took this spectrum, HST, you can see that the temperature is now changed, and we actually get a very nice fit here with using the using this Lyman alpha dip over here, this very deep turnover gives you a very good handle on the temperature. Thank you. And also, so this turnover here, and also there's this dip here near 1400 with a quasi-molecular feature that shows up under temperatures of 16,000. So we were actually able to fit this with a two-component white dwarf, 63% at 13,000 and 37% at 17,000. So we're off by a couple thousand from the optical because it's so complicated in the optical with the emission line surrounding the Balmer. So here's as we targeted the ones that we thought would have very low mass transfer rates. So as we targeted these, we were aiming to see what the lowest temperature we could find in accreting disk systems. So here's LL Land, 14,000. E.G. Cancri down to 12,000. Again, you can see how this Lyman alpha feature gives you the temperature constraint. And then Sophia and Boris did this peculiar one I think he mentioned yesterday, which is the coolest one that's been seen in a disk system. And you can see it with HST, here's the optical, again that little dip. In the ultraviolet, it's basically no continuum, and then you could start to get this rise past 1600. And you can fit that rise with a 10,500, 11,000 degree white dwarf. So it's very obvious what temperature you're in when you're dealing with the UV. In the normal case, you've got a combination of a disk and a white dwarf. And you can tell that not only because the emission lines are stronger, but here's the turnover to Lyman alpha. You can see that the flux down here does not go down to zero, which it should in the previous ones I've showed you. So what you can do is add in, that must be the contribution from the accretion disk that's still there. So with this kind of technique, you can fill in the contributions of the white dwarfing disk and still have some hope of getting a decent temperature. With some caveats. The caveats for this temperature fitting are that we cannot determine the log G, the temperature and log G are combined. So what, to sort this out, what we can do is use the constraints we have on distances, because there are some parallax measurements, we have a few distances, but primarily it's the V magnitude. Because if you take a white dwarf and extrapolate the model flux of that white dwarf, it must come below your observed optical magnitude for that system. So we can put a constraint on the, at least the lower value of log G by what the brightness in the optical is. And it's turned out that log G of 8 does fit all our systems, but really you can go up to log G's of 9 and you're still within the regime. But so the caveat is that you have to be careful what log G you're using, because the temperature that you determine does depend on that. Caveat 2 is that most of the system, the majority of the systems, are turning out to have a second component. Ed Sion just came out an IUE study of many systems. I think he did like 50 with his students, and found a second component must be there for more than 50%. The second component is shown nicely in this study of UGM by Knox Long in the last year. As you go to even shorter wavelengths than what you can get from HST, the second component shows up even more. So the long dashed line here is, so UGM typically has a 30,000 degree white dwarf. If you include the shorter wavelengths to get the best match, you must have the second component be hotter, which decreases the temperature of your white dwarf a little bit. So this longer dashed line is the 28,000 white dwarf coming in, and this shorter dashed line is what you need to fill in the second component, which is hotter. So those components are up near 70,000 degrees. So there's definitely something hot here, which may be the boundary layer or the inner disk. So we have the same situation for magnetic white dwarfs. We can wait for this for the mass transfer to turn off. And in magnetic systems, it turns out most of the time they are in these turned off states. So we can wait for one of these low states, or we can work on these very low accretion rate pulsars. And the situation there, EF Airy has been in a low state for close to 10 years now. And in this low state, you can see some irradiated component or some activity level on the secondary star. But you see the Zeeman split components of H alpha and the absorption lines from the 9,500 degree white dwarf. So we can get a pretty good fit to a white dwarf there. But the caveat here is there is also a second component. And as we look into more into the UV and time resolved work on these very low accretion rate systems, we're talking about 10 to the minus 14 solar masses per year probably coming over in a wind. You can see this is some GALAX data we have on EF Airy during this very 4 years into this low state. There is still a very highly modulated hot component there, at least 20,000 degrees. And this is the far UV and this is the near UV. That modulation is even more extreme in the far UV than it is in the optical. So there is definitely this hot component, even in a system that there is no mass transfer, there is still some hotter sections on the white dwarf that are there. And this is a LARP. This is one of the systems that have these very prominent cyclotron features. And if you subtract out the TIO bands from the secondary star, subtract out a model for the cyclotron features, as Lilia Ferraro has done for this system, the remaining light here, this little piece here and this little piece here, give you a constraint on the white dwarf temperature, and that white dwarf temperature must be 6,000 degrees. And here is an even more extreme case. The flux values between those cyclotron humps are very close to very minimal. And that means even at, you know, if temperatures are less than 5,000 degrees, the UV is not going to help you. This is the best you're going to do for these systems. So if you're dealing with a white dwarf that's cool, the age for that white dwarf is at least like 4 giga-years and it's probably never been heated very much. And here is our recent GALAX data on this same source that I just showed you. And again, it shows that same highly modulated flux in the far UV and the near UV. So it's not just something peculiar to one system, it apparently is there for many. So if you put all the temperatures together, this is the plot you get. And different people have done this in different ways. I've tried to only include the data from HST and FUSE, which are the best data that we have. But you know, if you include IUE and many, Ed has the same similar kind of plot, you get comparable results. So you can look at this plot and reach various conclusions. Those dark circles are the disk systems, and the triangles are the magnetic polar systems. And what you can see, basically three things from this plot. The coolest temperatures are at the shortest periods, which makes sense in terms of the accretion heating. Secondly, the white dwarfs, the triangles, the polars, are cooler than the disk systems in all cases. The low accretion rate polars, the ones where there's basically no accretion going on, are way down here at the lower limit. And this oddball dot right in the middle here is this Darrow O'Donohue's hibernating CVEC 1347. Which just looks completely like a detached system, except that the spin of the white dwarf is high, so he surmises it must be have been accreting in the past. And the third thing you can note in here is this very large oddball excess in temperatures at 3 to 4 hours, 3 to 3.5 hours. All those white dwarfs are very hot and high accretion rates. Okay, composition and rotation. To determine these parameters, you need very high resolution, a minimum of 1 angstrom. So you definitely need STIS or fuse data to resolve the lines. And the way this works, composition, again, going back to this, the fuse data on UGEM that Knox put out, shows this very nicely. The red here is a fit to solar abundance white dwarf, and the blue is with a varying composition. And you can see in lines of nitrogen, so the red would be solar, you need more nitrogen to make the fit. Same thing over here. The blue is more nitrogen to make the fit. In carbon, the blue is less than solar. And this is the common result that's come about from composition fitting across a variety of systems. Nitrogen is enhanced and carbon is depleted. To get rotation out of this, what we do is the light gray here is STIS data. We can broaden the model to white dwarf based on the rotation rates. So at high rotations, the lines get smeared. At low rotation rates, lines are sharper. And that you convolve that with the composition, because they kind of go together as well. The depth of the line will depend on the composition as well as the rotation rate. And you can sort out if you use, you're particular about which lines you use, you can sort out the rotation effects from the composition effects. And for this particular case, the rotation is 200. You can see the best matches with the narrow cores and enhanced abundances. So for compositions, basically what's come out of the studies of, I don't know, 15, 20 systems now, the disk systems have basic compositions that are 1/10 or 3/10 solar for the white dwarfs, where nitrogen is generally enhanced and carbon is depleted. In the magnetic system, the polars, there are no metals. And it's thought that the magnetic field basically pushes the metals down below the surface. Boris already talked about this difference in nitrogen-carbon in these 10 systems, which are both magnetic and non-magnetic. So this is probably an indicator of two different population types, one an evolved path to a CV, and the other is part of a normal path. We're also seeing the same kind of result in the secondaries that Steve Howell, Tom Harrison, and I have been doing this study of the secondaries in systems, and it turns out that if you look at the disk systems, all the secondaries are basically depleted in CO, where in magnetic systems, the secondaries are completely normal. And this is just an example of what this looks like. So for UGEM, this is a disk system. The dotted lines are normal M stars of these spectral types. And the solid line is UGEM. And so we try to fit these lines with different compositions. Thanks. And you can see that it's not just a dilution effect of the disk, because the sodium and calcium lines fit quite well, but CO is always depleted in the systems with disks. So here's just a compilation, and you can't look at all these numbers, but basically the rotation rates what we get are all under 400 kilometers per second, so they're fairly low rotators, much faster than just DA white dwarfs, so they are spun up. And this hibernating CV is also spun up to that same rate, but nowhere near the breakup. So they are getting rid of their excess angular momentum. And the metals have various enhancements in the disk CVs. So where we stand now in these four properties, the masses, we still need a lot more masses. But it's apparent that the masses, all the masses we see are high mass. We don't get any of those low mass white dwarfs that should be there. Temperatures, we have a pretty good handle on the temperature problem, but there appears to be the second component, which is messing up our temperatures. So the actual temperatures of the white dwarf might be actually lower if you add in the second component that seems to be there in both polars and disk systems. compositions show a clear separation into the systems with disks versus magnetic systems, so the evolutionary paths may be actually different. But it's not clear why exactly that is the case. The secondary seem to show this very clear distinction as well. I mean, you can solve the metal lack of metals with the magnetic fields, but you can't solve the secondary problem in that same way. That's what this means. The rotation rates are basically low. If you look at the separate out the second component in temperature and look at its rotation compared to the white dwarf, the second component always has a higher rotation. So that could be some outer layer of the white dwarf that's spun up. It could be that boundary layer where the disk meets the white dwarf. But basically the rotations are less than breakup, but certainly larger than single white dwarfs. And I'll stop there.
Thank you for this wonderful review. There is time for a lot of questions. And
you had mentioned that the masses in these systems seem to be higher than you'd expect for isolated white dwarfs, and I'd like to invite you to speculate on whether that comes because of some physical thing that selects these because of the mass transfer process or an observational selection effect, or whether they're really more massive and have been gaining mass.
Well, I mean, there's been this debate for a long time whether, and I think Ron Webbing might be able to comment on this. I mean, he looked at the systems like that are short orbital period versus longer orbital period to see if there should be a mass difference. And there's been various answers during the years, depending on which masses you use to look at this. But, I mean, that list I showed you had systems that were 80 minutes and systems that were 6 hours. And there doesn't seem to be any difference. I mean, we have a limited sample. What can you say from 10 systems, right? But, you know, it doesn't seem to be an evolutionary difference in terms of, you know, where you're starting out versus where you're ending up. And in terms of the selection effects, I mean, we've got some of the higher mass systems, I mean, longer orbital period, higher mass transfer systems, as well as the low, so I don't think it's totally selection. I mean, we're selecting out the ones that we can actually see the white dwarf, so there are selection effects going on in the terms of when the mass transfer turns off and things like that. I don't know how else we can do it. So I think it's certainly an open question. It seems to be we're certainly not seeing the helium white dwarfs, and I think we should be, right?
Paula, can you go back to the temperature versus orbital period plot? Yes.
Well, that's what I'm up. Yeah.
Right. Those four systems between 3 and 4 hours, are those VY Skoll systems that are in the low state? Is that how you measure the white dwarf temperature?
Yeah, we've got MV Lyra in there, DW UMA. Basically, the ones that have maybe I didn't mention this. These are all systems during quiescence, so we think they've reached their except for these, where the quiescence doesn't last that long. Those four are ones where it's completely turned off, and you're seeing the bare stars.
Right, so three of those four have temperatures as high as for any systems independent of orbital period.
That's right.
Yet the mass transfer rate should be lower between 3 and 4 hours than at longer periods. So I was just wondering if you had an explanation for why those white dwarfs.
Brian Warner had this explanation. I don't see if I can remember it right. It had to do with, I think, because the Roche lobe is shrinking down as you go to shorter periods, it's like a combination of the secondary star filling at that period. And so you should get a higher mass transfer rate here, whereas as the Roche lobe grows, as the secondary gets larger, there's kind of more space, and so the transfer rate goes down again. Does anybody else remember that argument better?
There's a theoretical version that says these systems could be ones that just come into contact above the period gap, and when they do that, they're in sort of a thermal mass transfer phase for a while, and that gives them a very high mass transfer rate, and then they very quickly become gap systems and turn off. So during this time, they could be systems with a higher mass transfer rate than from the normal evolution because they started there.
The low accretion rate pulsars, or LORPs, I've heard them called prepolars because they haven't yet come into Roche Lobe overflow, but, you know, it's capturing the wind of the secondary because the magnetic field of the primary wraps around it and captures its wind. But the fact that the white dwarfs are always, at least in the cases where they've been measured, and it seemed to me there was one recent discovery where you couldn't see the white dwarf continuum at all in Gary Schmidt's latest paper that you're a co-author of. They must be post-pulsars, even though they have similar periods to active pulsars. They somehow lose Roche Lobe contact as the white dwarf gets very cool. Is that a plausible scenario?
Well, I don't know if there. I mean, we've now got this confusion between systems that go into basically a LARP state. EFAIRY has gone into basically a LARP state, but its white dwarf is still hot. So it's just depending on what you're going to choose as where the white dwarf is in its evolutionary path and how actually cool it can be for its lifetime. I don't know. We just don't. You know, the basic question in my mind is, why does a mass transfer turn off in magnetic systems much more so than it does in this system? They seem to have the same kind of white dwarfs, the same type of secondaries, and yet one is turning off and on and the other isn't. Is it related to the magnetic cycle? You know. No, because it's a white dwarf. Yeah, but its white dwarf is hot, so it's had some accretion. If you've got a white dwarf of 9,500, it's not the same as, in my mind at least, it's not the same as these LARPs, which are under 6,000 and are, you know, have never had episodes of massive accretion. Otherwise, they'd be heated, or at least in recent history. You know, how far you have to, you know, wait to get down below 6,000. But, you know, EFAIRY is definitely hotter. So I think the ones that, you know, going intermittently in and out of a LARP state will be hotter than these really true LARPs, which maybe never have had accretion. But I think, you know, all this is pointing to the fact that wind accretion is much more common than we actually thought, because there's definitely no stream. You don't see any effects of a stream. So it's only just this wind from the brown dwarf or the M star that's doing enough to keep, you know, keep some accretion going onto the white dwarf.
We had a question in the back there.
Voila, that depletion in the secondary, is that the CO molecule or are it the C and O atomic elements?
It's the Let's see. Steve knows more about the modeling of those. I mean, yeah.
Since you showed the infrared CO line, as
I didn't show. I mean, the infrared spectra have a very. It's the series of the CO that you actually model. It's not just one feature in here that we showed for.
Yeah, but it's a molecule, or is it the elements, the atomic elements that are depleted?
Yeah, it's the molecule of the,
it's a molecule.
Of the CO,
okay.
And we
Thank
see.
You.
We can see, I mean, we also actually see things from the disk coming out in WZ Sagitti. I mean, there's a hydrogen molecule that appears that's there in the infrared as well. So, but that is different from the abundance thing. That's prevented us from detecting some of the brown dwarfs in these objects, which is what we were originally trying to do.
Just a comment to Jim's question. Some of these LARPs definitely can't have accreted because their secondary stars are too small to fill their Roche lobes. So they can't be polars that switched off. They just are not yet Roche lobe thinning. Their spectral types are too late for the orbital periods that they have. So they need to shrink to short orbital periods before they can turn on mass transfer.
But I think some of the active accreters also seem to shrink within their Roche lobe too. Isn't that the case in a couple of these?
No,
so,
not, well, they,
I mean, they're right at the edge, and I think they're kind of moving in and out.
Well, just
depending on how you determine
you,
the,
you
the
just,
size.
You just change by some scale height, maybe, of the atmosphere, but you don't change the radius of the star. I mean, these are substantially underfitting their Roche lobe, so they meet still hundreds of millions of years before they evolve into contact. They accrete from the wind. From the wind, yes. And these are accretion rates of 10 to the minus 14 or so solar masses per year. So these are really low rates that we're talking about.